In Vancouver, I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Robert Bateman joins me now. He is a world-renowned wildlife artist and conservationist. He has just published a new book, a collection of some riveting and mesmerizing art depicting mammals, birds, and other wildlife, and more. There are over 100 full-color reproductions, and though I don't have an eye for art, even I know there are magnificent pieces here. There are short essays as well in this book, and a marvelous view onto Mr. Bateman's views on environmentalism, education, art, and the wilderness, among other things. The book is called Bateman, New Works, and it's also a gorgeous book in its design. Greystone is its publisher. Robert Bateman is on the line from Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, where he lives and paints. He's an officer of the Order of Canada and a member of the Order of British Columbia, and the many other accolades bestowed on this man are legion and would take several minutes to list. His website is at robertbateman.ca, and there's another website with his writing, batemanideas.com. I am pleased to welcome to the Plant Online program Robert Bateman. Good morning, Mr. Bateman.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So when you called me last week to do the interview, I wasn't prepared because it's sort of inside baseball stuff. The publicist had emailed several weeks prior saying that you were available. I said yes. Well, I never heard back from her.
Right.
And I didn't have the book, so I went out this weekend and bought the book.
Oh, you poor guy. They should have sent you a book, too.
No, man. The book, I mean, it's well worth it. It's just a tremendous book. I mean, it just looks good as well. I mean, were you pleased how it turned out?
Absolutely. You know, some people say it's my best book. It's the fifth coffee table book of my works. I had another coffee table book called Birds in between, so there's now six in total, plus I think it's four children's books. But yeah, this is the last one, and it's a totally new format. I've gone with a new publisher. My other publisher in Toronto got under new management, and they seemed to kind of lose interest a bit, and normally I had a book every 5 years, and mm-hmm. 5 years rolled by, 6 years, 7 years, and I kept saying, how about it? And they said, well, maybe we'll do a retrospective. And I said, well, listen, you'll do a retrospective when I get old. So I'll let you know when I get old. But meantime, I just want all my new paintings. And so this is the result of this new publisher for me, Greystone. And I'm delighted to share Greystone with people like David Suzuki and Brian Brett and other people I admire a lot.
Yeah, they've had a great list the last year or so.
Mm-hmm.
How much say do you have in terms of how this is set up? Like what's on the cover and what's in the book?
Well, when I'm faced with how a book is set up, I'm not a designer in that sense of the word. I can design a rectangle or a format for a picture, but a book, we've gone in a kind of straightforward, conservative way for all the other books, and we've been geographical. So we start around home and then start ranging up to the Arctic and down to the deserts and then Europe and Africa, etc. And then within the geographical, we did seasonal. So that's just a logical kind of easy way to do it, and it's fine. It works beautifully. This way, there's an award-winning designer at Greystone called Peter Cocking, and he had his own idea, so I was thrilled to just let him. He designs a lot of artsy books, and he's got a more, I guess, avant-garde artsy mentality than I do. And actually, the layout is Peter's whim.
Mm-hmm.
And he would send me the first cut, and then I'd have opinions on certain things that I'd like this next to that one, perhaps. And so we had a bit of back and forth, but basically, the book is Peter's book of my works.
The cover is you don't know what it is until you go into the book and see it again, and you see what the caption says. It's an elephant skull.
It is. It's right. Yeah. It could be a Henry Moore sculpture. And
yeah.
I love, of course, skulls and bones, as many artists do, and Henry Moore obviously did. They have such a sculptural quality. That's the other interesting thing, because all the other books have had, I think, their eye on the animal lover market, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
The first book was a fox looking at you, you know, straight eye contact, the way women's magazines always have the woman looking straight in the eye. and the fox looks you straight in the eye, and then I have a squirrel with a fluffy tail pointing towards you, and then I have an owl looking at you. And so they're more, I wouldn't say they're cute or anything, but they're more sort of eye appeal and psychological contact with you. But this one's a skull, and just kind of big abstract bone shapes with strong sidelight, and then a little plover down in the corner, partly for scale and partly gives a little nugget of life. So it has a much more artsy feel to it because it's a bit more edgy.
And so we're on the internet radio that to describe your work, it's realism, right?
Yeah, it's that's right. It's I don't know these words, photorealism and magic realism and all that. Kind of meaningless to me. I want to give the people the feeling they are there and that there's a real place and there's a real time when they look at one of my. There was a National Film Board film made on me back quite a few years ago, and the scriptwriter said, Robert Bateman captures a moment in time, a moment that could have happened. Almost never do these moments have actually happened, but they want them to look as if they could have happened.
Did you ever see an elephant skull?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Tons of them. Oh, yeah. Well, I wouldn't say tons of them, but yeah, I've seen them. Many. That one was actually from Tsavo East Park in Kenya, and they had a terrible series of years of drought a few years ago, and there were elephant skeletons all over the place. Then, of course, you get the big issue of elephant skeletons resulting from poaching of tusks.
Yeah. So when you're painting this, is this from a photograph or is this from memory?
I don't work from memory. I'm against the cooked-up look. Mm-hmm. I can work from memory, and I can cook up. But when I cook up, or when anybody else, I challenge anyone else who does not work from reality, either photography or real life, to not have the kind of cooked up look. And that look is okay, but to me, it starts to look kind of commercial. I can do. A spruce forest beside a lake, but it starts to look like a Canadian Tire Store ad. and that's okay, but I don't want it to look like that.
Yeah.
I want it to be very particular. So I use 5 to 50 photographs in the average painting as reference, but I've never found a photograph is enough. So I modify the photograph and move things around and change the shadows and change the lighting, and sometimes change the lighting very drastically. But I want the particularity from the real world, because in my world, the real world is so much more complex and interesting than our human brain or human eye could ever come up with.
On average, how long does a painting take?
It's hard to say on average. Years ago, I tried to time one or two for the fun of it, but
yeah.
I work on 5 or 10 at once, so like one took 6 years. Because I just hated it most of the time, and I would just pick at it a little bit. I like my paintings when I first start, and then the fact that sometimes I like them better before I start, and then I start, and look, they have promise, and then they always get worse, almost always. They go downhill, and in my own mind, they get worse, and I don't know what to do. I don't like them, and I don't know why I don't like them. If I knew why, then I'd fix it. And so I found, so I start a new one to cheer me up, and it looks great, and then it gets worse. And I start the third one, and by the time the fifth one is looking pretty horrible, the first one doesn't look quite as bad. So then I somehow or other, the muse comes down from Mount Olympus. Something happens. It's got to be in my brain, but it's intuition or something comes to me, and I say, oh yeah, maybe if I try this, and constantly making mistakes. A great teacher once said, in order to learn how to draw, you have to make at least 2,000 mistakes. Get busy and start making them. And I taught for 20 years. I taught high school art, and one of the worst things in a high school art class where the kids were afraid of their own work. They'd put something down And, you know, they're just a kid, and it would be okay, but it could be a lot better. But they'd say, "What? You know, I don't want to change it. I mean, what if it's right? I mean, I'd say, come on, it's just a piece of art. It doesn't matter." And I'll frequently paint over something I may have spent a whole week on, or maybe even a whole month on. I'll just scrape it down with a razor blade to get the bumps out, and then paint it over and start again on it.
What's your day like? Do you paint all day?
Yes, I start, first thing in the morning after I do the evening dishes. Birgit, my wife, does the cooking, and I do the cleanup and get the kitchen all clean and sweep the floor and everything in the morning while my brain and my body are kind of getting into gear. And then I do a hike or a bike ride around our property. We live, we're lucky we live here on Salt Spring Island, a bit of acreage, and so I've got all kinds of trails I can go hiking on, and again, just see what's happening in nature and get the blood flowing. And it's usually about 9:30 or 10 o'clock when I get in here, and I've got two full-time assistants, and they've got emails that are coming in, or interviews like this one they're setting up or something. And I sit down at my easel, and I can normally paint while I'm talking on the phone, but at this moment, I'm staring at a painting, so I'm painting in my head about the things I intend to do to it, but I don't have a paintbrush in my hand. And so then that goes on till lunchtime. We have lunch, and then Birgit and I go for about a 20 to 40-minute hike, have a nap, and then back at the easel, and then in the evening I get on the... At 5:30, I get on the exercise bike and watch the BBC World Service News. Then I have the TV going pretty well all evening while I paint, but I hate commercials. So it would be Knowledge Network here in British Columbia, or we can get TV Ontario because we've got a satellite,
mm-hmm.
or PBS down in Seattle, and watching documentaries and shows of that sort till 10 o'clock, and then go to bed, hopefully read for half an hour or so, and so that's like that 7 days a week, unless I have interruptions. And I have lots of interruptions.
Yeah, how long have you lived on Salt Spring?
Since 1985.
And what brought you here?
Well, my best buddy, Bristol Foster, who used to be, he was director of the BC Provincial Museum in Victoria during its heyday, when it was built as, in my view, the most beautiful. I think the museum in Victoria is the best museum in the world to visit. It's a good size, etc. And he was director, and then he became director of ecological reserves, and then he's currently, well, of course, we're all of a certain age. I'm 80, as I guess you know, and he's in his late 70s. He's the guy I went around the world with in a Land Rover. Well, we were living in Toronto, and he moved out west to be director of the museum. And there's nothing worse than an ex-Torontonian who's moved to British Columbia. They take this attitude of, you could be living in paradise while you're still living in purgatory.
Yeah.
And of course, being an artist, I could live wherever I wanted. And Birgit's from Vancouver, and we kept coming out to visit here. And I got I fell in love with BC, to make a long story short.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. And in 1985, we made the move.
Do you draw as well?
Yeah, I do a lot of drawing when I'm on trips. I don't, except on my paintings, I don't draw, quote, sketching here. But when I'm on trips, I have innumerable sketchbooks that record different things that have happened on trips.
Who do you admire?
Artistically or environmentally, or it's a huge list.
Yeah.
Artistically, I think Andrew Wyeth would be the pivotal artist, and then Vermeer, Degas. That's probably enough.
Yeah.
Artists for a while. Of course, I admire David Suzuki and all. There's so many wonderful environmentalists out there whose work I admire too.
Do you ever wonder how your life would be like if you didn't have art in it?
That would not be possible. It wouldn't have happened. But I didn't really expect to support myself with my art. I went into teaching so I could paint from the heart, just paint for fun of it. And I didn't sell anything until I was 35, and I was a full-time teacher till I was 46. So I just gave away my painting. So, my degree's in geography, by the way. I don't think you need to take art to be an artist. It's in your heart, and it's because you can't stop doing it. Even though I taught art for 20 years, I don't think art education is essential, except maybe in elementary school. I think music is maybe more important. Anyway, I just can't stop doing art, but because I took geography, I'm interested in demographics, and everybody is a result of demographics and where and when they live. And I am benefiting. If I'd been born 10 or 20 years earlier, I would not have had the wonderful life that I have had, because I came along and my art started to get noticed when there was a generation coming up. Suburbia was being built. The people, the young couples that were building suburbia, had grown up on watching television, The Wonderful World of Disney and Marlon Perkins' Wild Kingdom, and they knew nature was wonderful. Before about 1970, or really 1975 or 80, you didn't see wildlife art on walls. It was in magazine illustrations, but it wasn't art that you'd frame and put on walls. But all of a sudden, people felt, nature is beautiful and vulnerable, and the TV nature shows, I think, encouraged that. Also, environmentalism started, and people in suburbia suddenly had walls, and that's how my prints got going, and the prints started, and then all these books that I mentioned, the last of which we're talking about today.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of where I live. But if I hadn't lived in that era, I would have still done art till the day I died. But I might not have been able to sell any of it.
The importance of art to young people, to children. Do you think there's enough of it in their lives?
No, I don't. But I don't feel that as deeply as I don't enough nature in their lives. I don't think everybody should be an artist. That's a gift. Just like everybody isn't going to be a singer or a good guitar player or a good hockey player. But I think everybody should be and would benefit from being a naturalist. And I started out when I got serious at the age of 12. All little kids like art and nature, but most normal human beings give it up around the age of 12 or 13, and I just haven't given up yet. And so I went home from school and did art every day, and I had my first bird list when I was 12 years old. So I strongly feel in schools and from parents and everything, we should have more nature being disseminated to kids. But from the age of, I'd say about 10 or 11, kids start to notice. Some kids are gifted, and every time I try to draw a horse, it looks stupid. But Johnny or Sarah can do, they're good at it, and I'm no good at it, but I'm good at basketball. So that's when it starts out, and I don't think you should have kids doing art if they're not artists.
Now, you've been a successful artist commercially. In terms of critical success, the critics were pretty hard at you at the beginning, right?
Well, it depends on what critics.
Yeah.
I've had way, way, way more accolades, all out of proportion in a sense, to what other people get. And because I'm a little bit famous, I'm a Canada's a small pond, and I'm a relatively big fish in a small pond. I attract attention. And sometimes they say it's, you know, the Japanese saying it's the tall poppy syndrome. If anybody sticks their head up, they become a target, and they and there's always somebody there. You know, there is a school of thought saying critics write for other critics because they don't want to seem to be a patsy. And so this is something that I've, it's not at all surprising, and in a sense it's an honor. And the other thing I touched on earlier a little bit with the design of the book, because my work is not generally very edgy, it is a bit, and especially at times. I've done, there's one or two edgy pieces like the tiger parts for sale piece in the book that have an edge to it. Contemporary art priesthood, as I call them, they want something to have an edge to it to give you a sense of discomfort when you look at it. And so anybody that would be sort of like Norman Rockwell is easily palatable is of no interest to them. But I've had often I'm asked in interviews that, you know, why have you not got any respect from art museums? And actually, I have got all kinds of respect from all kinds of art museums. The biggest show that the McMichaels, I think the third biggest art museum in Canada, McMichael Collection just outside Toronto, featuring the Group of Seven and others. And they broke all their attendance records when they had the show of my work there a couple of years ago. The Smithsonian, which is the Museum of Natural History, mind you, had a show in 87 which broke all their attendance records in history. And I've had a major show at the Joslin Fine Art Museum in Omaha. It's a big establishment art museum, so it's under the same roof with El Greco and Matisse and, you know, all the big guys. And I've had show at the Art Gallery of Hamilton, the Art Gallery of Victoria, etc. So I'm well taken care of by the art critics, and certainly by tremendous amount of other critics. So I don't feel neglected.
Yeah. Is there anything else in your life that you want to accomplish?
No, I'm not ambitious in that sense. Not just even when I reach a certain age, I would just love it to continue. Mm-hmm. I'm getting such a bang out of it. To be honest, it just popped into my head. The major thing I hope gets accomplished before too long is the Robert Bateman Center at Railroad University. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
Right.
We're right on the cusp of a big, new, important thrust in the fundraising phase of it. But it's Railroad University, just west of Victoria, is, I've never had this denied, the most beautiful campus in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got 550 acres of old-growth forest and beautiful view of the Olympics, the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and a castle, and a 1906 Japanese garden, and Tuscan garden, and a wonderful school dedicated to sustainability and leadership. And we hope to have a beautiful Bateman Center that's going to deal with environmental problems and also display my art.
There's a painting in the book. It's entitled Family Hike, and I see you in there.
Yes.
Is that from a photograph?
Yeah. I'd say you could virtually everything is.
Yeah.
Unless it's from a dead bird, you know, which I have in the hand. The very last, somewhere in the book is a picture of a dead woodcock, a detailed ballpoint pen drawing of a dead woodcock.
Yeah.
Somewhere near the end of the that photograph is of our, of my own family, but it's changed around so much it's barely recognizable. I added people, I subtracted people, I put the dog in, which I made up out of my head, which I don't approve of, but works fine. I had, you know, the little kids running, I added in, and I changed so much of it. I made it from a winter picture to a fall color picture, etc. But it did start out with a photograph, and that's a big maple tree about a 5-minute walk from our house here.
Well, what's it like to paint yourself?
I haven't tried a serious self-portrait for years. I thought I should try again. I've got halfway through doing a sculpture of my a head, a bust like of myself. You're looking in the mirror, so you don't. So the end product is not the way other people see you. I'd like to try it, but you know, what I'd probably do is work from a photograph of myself, and I like doing people, so I think I would probably treat it just as a picture of a person, just as it would be. Could be a bird, could be a bear, could be a still life. You're still dealing with light and shade and the various principles of wanting things to come forward and recede, and doing a little bit of editing and that kind of thing.
Bob, it's been both a pleasure and a privilege to speak to you today. I appreciate it.
Well, it's been a great pleasure for me. Thank you very much for putting me on.
You're very welcome. The websites for more are robertbateman.ca, and of course the website with his writing is at batemanideas.com. The book is called Bateman, New Works. It's published by Greystone from Salt Spring Island, British Columbia. Robert Bateman on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.